Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. Coming up, protecting our food supply. Tainted spinach, ground beef, and peanut butter are just some of the recent consumer scares. How good a job does the federal government do in keeping our food safe?
The fact that this industry has gone for so long without the government saying you have to do these things to ensure safety in the marketplace is quite surprising.
We'll hear about major changes coming to the nation's food protection laws. Also, dangers that could be lurking in your own kitchen, like lettuce with tiny bacteria that can make you sick.
Little rods of bacteria and strings coming out of them like ropes. I think of them as mountain climbers. And they are hooked on to that product, and they're not going to let go.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. And welcome to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. Well, it seems hardly a week goes by these days without some kind of food scare. Tainted spinach one day, peanut butter or ground beef the next. In a national radio address earlier this year, President Obama called these outbreaks a painful reminder of what happens when food producers act irresponsibly and government is unable to do its job.
These incidents reflect a troubling trend that's seen the average number of outbreaks from contaminated produce and other foods grow to nearly 350 a year, up from 100 a year in the early 1990s.
This hour, we're delving into food safety, and we begin with what the federal government is doing to keep us safe. We put that question to a pair of Food and Drug Administration officials. First, Mike Taylor, a senior advisor to FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg. I asked him where the current system of food safety falls short.
Well, we're operating under laws that go back 100 years and that really equip the government to do little more than react to problems after they occur. And what we've learned in the last couple of decades really is that the only way to really have the food supply that is as safe as it can be is to prevent problems. And so we need to really fundamentally shift the federal program from one that's reactive to one that is fundamentally preventive, you know, so that we're not simply reacting after the fact.
And what does it take to make that happen? What kinds of changes?
Well, we need a statutory mandate that would hold all food companies accountable for implementing modern preventive control procedures. These are the techniques that many companies already implement, where it's simply a matter of understanding, you know, scientifically the potential hazards in an operation and putting in place controls that are designed and demonstrated to be effective in minimizing the hazards. So you've got microbial pathogens that can enter in any number of ways. We need to know what those are, and we need to put in place the processing measures that will eliminate them.
So give us an example of a uniform standard that you'd like to see in place that currently is not.
We know that if we systematically analyze the hazards, the potential for contamination of a product in a particular operation, that we can then design the controls that will eliminate it, whether it's the time and temperature of cooking of a product. Maybe it's doing environmental sampling to detect a pathogen in the environment so that we can be sure we're sanitizing the facility properly. There are a whole set of tools we've got today that if applied systematically, can reduce the likelihood that product will be contaminated. So the first thing really is just to ensure that all companies are observing those sorts of modern state-of-the-art preventive techniques.
And so in addition to FDA creating these enforceable standards that are uniform and well communicated throughout the country, to what extent does the FDA or should the FDA be involved in, say, inspecting food plants?
Well, that's the other side of the coin, and that's critically important because, again, the government's real contribution on food safety is to set these modern standards, to set the standard of care, and then to conduct the kind of inspection and enforcement activity that will achieve high rates of compliance with those standards. So it won't suffice to have the standards without the compliance, but it won't suffice to just inspect if you don't have the right standards in place. So we really have to be doing both of those things.
And do you have the resources to do either?
Well, historically, FDA has not had the resources to adequately inspect. Congress is in the process of considering legislation that would address that, including for the first time actually giving FDA a mandate to achieve certain frequencies of inspection. And then also in a bill that passed the House of Representatives last month would give us some additional resources through a a registration fee that the companies would pay to generate a stream of revenue to support more inspection and other activities. So we do need to be inspecting more. We need to be inspecting in a more modern way, but we need the resources to do both of those things.
At this point, what kind of authority does the FDA have to fine an importer or a producer, a grower who violates the standards?
Well, no authority to fine the producers, the importers, or the growers. There is no civil penalty authority generally in the food program at FDA. This is one of the authorities that it would be desirable to have.
Was that in the bill that the House passed recently?
Yes, there is civil penalty authority and. There are other enforcement tools that we really need. We need mandatory recall authority. So when product is in commerce and needs to be recalled, we can, if necessary, order a recall. So there are a number of strengthened enforcement authorities that we need and that the House bill would include.
I mean, no offense intended, but it sounds like the FDA is currently pretty toothless. I mean, there's no standards you can enforce. You can't really do all the inspections that are required. You have no authority to recall, and there are no penalties you can impose.
The system needs transformation, and I think there's no getting around that. It's been challenged and in some cases overwhelmed by changes in the food supply. So, we're in a very dynamic, challenging environment with tools that are antiquated, and I think the agency, needs help from Congress to really make the great leap forward that people deserve.
That's Mike Taylor, a senior advisor to FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg. And now David Acheson. Until he left the FDA 3 weeks ago, he was Associate Commissioner for Foods. I asked Dr. Acheson to give us a sense of how globalization has complicated efforts to protect the food supply.
It's mainly reflected in what we euphemistically call the global food supply. And the fact that we're now able to and enjoy foods from all over the world pretty much 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And what that results in is food coming from all parts of the world. For example, at FDA, we regulate about 80% of the food supply, or thereabouts. And we import food from over 150 countries that come through all 300-plus ports in the United States. And depending on the food commodity, 80% of that, like seafood, may be imported. Fresh produce, depending on the time of year, maybe 50-60%. And that's all compounded by the rapid and complex distribution chains. Years ago, food was produced locally, not exclusively, but it was often produced locally, consumed locally, and wasn't getting into a really complex distribution system. We've had some recent examples of how small firms, I think the classic one lately was the peanut butter firm in Georgia, who was a small peanut butter producer who produced a product that went all over the United States and it resulted in a large outbreak of salmonella, went to close to 400 different secondary firms who were using that product to make food, led to close to 4,000 recalls when that problem occurred. And that's just an illustration of the complexities that we're dealing with. And the whole system is operating very fast these days, so that food's distributed all over the world in a matter of days, if not hours.
You mentioned just how much food comes into this country. 150 countries export food to the U.S. There's a lot of food production in the U.S. as well. How can you possibly ensure the safety of all that food? How do you go about it?
Well, one has to take a risk-based approach to ensure safety. There's a lot of question about inspecting food and how much food to inspect, and there's just no logical way for all the food to be inspected all the time. It is a responsibility of industry to produce safe food. I mean, that's an important upfront statement to make, and the vast majority of industry take that responsibility very seriously. What FDA has to do is to be astute and aware of where the risks may be occurring. So we talk about developing and using a risk-based approach, which means looking at foods where there's a history of a problem, looking at countries where we repeatedly see food that's problematic, looking at the types of food which are very difficult to ensure that they're safe because they're perhaps a raw product. A classic example would be leafy greens like lettuce and spinach, where we've had a series of problems. It's a product that's grown outside in the dirt. And albeit it's usually washed before it's consumed, it's not cooked. There isn't a kill step, as we call it. So that's inherently a higher risk food. So based on all of that, we will then target our inspectional strategies. who we're going to inspect, how often we inspect them, what samples we'll take, what we will test that food for, what we're going to focus on at the port of entry in terms of inspections and testing, so that we are optimizing the use of our available resources based on risk. And it is essentially a sliding scale because it's while inspection is absolutely critical, and we need to do more of them, and we need to do more enforcement because it doesn't do any good for having industry recognize they need to do the right thing, but if the cops are never showing up, then things will slide. That's just human nature. So we have to be out there ensuring that that's being followed.
When you say that you need to focus on foods and countries that have been problematic in the past, you mentioned leafy greens. In terms of countries, which countries do you flag?
I don't want to single out a particular country. We have had a series of concerns with products from places. How to put this? We have a system. Let me back up a little bit. We have a system called import alerts, in which when we have a concern about a product, we will put it on what we call an import alert, which puts the burden on the importing firm to demonstrate to us that the product is safe. Those are usually done on a manufacturer-to-manufacturer basis for an individual product. Occasionally, we will go countrywide when we've got a concern about a certain type of product throughout the whole country. For example, in China, we have just done several of those. Historically, we did one on aquacultured seafood, covering 5 different types of seafood a couple of years ago. And then more recently, when there was melamine in dairy products in China, which killed babies, mercifully, that did not get imported into the United States. But we put a countrywide import alert. So that's an example. We've also had situations where we've done the same thing with Mexico with regard to cantaloupes because of recurring problems with salmonella. So it sort of follows down the line of which foods, which countries have we seen repeated problems. And it can shift and vary depending on what's going on.
How responsive and cooperative is a country like China with regard to this?
China's very cooperative. They realize that, number one, public health is important to them as much as it is to us. Number two, that their economy, their export economy, is dependent on getting safe food into countries like ours. So we've done a lot of work with the Chinese government to find ways to make sure that the foods that they are exporting are safe. We've had a lot of negotiations with China, and under the past administration, set up agreements with China, which are still in effect. We established FDA personnel in China, which was a first. We'd never done that before. And that was a model that we expanded to South Latin America, Europe, and India, where we actually have FDA people situated overseas. But China, we have about a dozen people in China right now, and a big part of what they do is interact with the Chinese government to discuss how do we ensure that the products that they are sending to us are safe. And when a problem occurs, we've got somebody right on site to go and help sort it out.
When you think about all the food that comes into this country, what percentage of it would you say is actually inspected?
100% of it goes through our systems. It goes through electronic surveillance, electronic assessment, through a system that we call OASIS. So every food item that comes into the United States, it has information attached to it, usually electronic, and it is screened electronically by the FDA computer system.
What does that mean? What do you find through that kind of screening?
Well, what we do there is we set these systems up to flag anything where we've got a concern. So we can change the parameters in that system that when we've got a concern about a particular food or a particular country because we've seen a problem, we simply put that information into the computer system and it will flag that product. Now, when it does that, what then happens is that import information is then looked at physically by an FDA employee. So there's a person looking at that information who will then check our records, our systems. Do we have a problem? Do we have a concern? And if we do, that person will put a secondary flag on it, which will determine that it will be stopped, held, inspected, and potentially tested. So 100% is screened, and at the end of the day, currently about 1% of foods, depending on the type of food, certain types of seafood, it's higher than that, maybe 2 or 3%, is then physically stopped, inspected, and tested.
Does that seem adequate to you?
It isn't adequate. We need to do more. part of the money that we're getting in 2009 or have got in 2009 and hope to get in 2010 will be used to augment this screening and inspection process.
Dr. David Acheson, since we spoke to him a few weeks ago, he left the FDA to head up food safety for a private consulting firm. To see the food inspection system up close, Health Dialogue's producer Nick Vidinsky visited the Port of Los Angeles. He followed FDA investigators as they decided which foods to let into the country and which to turn away. There's an audio slideshow of Nick's trip on our website at healthdialogues.org. Overhauling the nation's food system is on the agenda when Congress returns after the August recess, along with health care, of course. Reporter Sarah Varney looks at how the legislation shaping up in Washington could affect a California industry hit hard by food safety problems, the produce industry.
Almost 80% of the lettuce produced in the United States comes from California. Much of it is grown here in the Salinas Valley. At Ocean Mist Farms in Castroville, dozens of farm workers covered in sweatshirts, hats, and bandanas use long knives to harvest romaine hearts. They hand the lettuce to workers who spray it with water and pack three hearts to a bag. The spinach contaminated by E. coli bacteria that killed three people and sickened hundreds in 2006 came from a processing plant not far from here. When the outbreak began, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration advised Americans not to eat spinach, and the entire spinach and leafy greens industry went into a tailspin. After the outbreak, California's leafy greens producers were keen to restore consumer confidence.
So here's his inspection form. This is a weekly inspection form of, you know, just sort of the good housekeeping of his operation.
The industry created a voluntary program that set safety measures for everything from worker hygiene to irrigation to buffer zones between agricultural fields and cattle feedlots. Ocean Mist Farms' Joe Pizzini points to a detailed inspection log that foreman Daniel Perez Hernandez is filling out.
Okay, so this question asks him if the bathrooms are put in an appropriate place to prevent contamination of the product. Okay, so they wouldn't put the bathrooms in the field. So
the inspection log is pages long. Foremen at all Ocean Mist operations must verify employees are wearing hairnets, plastic gloves, and washing their hands after using the bathroom. To make that part easier, all the sinks are on the outside of the porta-potties. They test the water used to spray the lettuce and clean the knives. Farms that have signed on to the industry standards must keep similar records and submit them to auditors. Pizzini chairs the advisory board that oversees the safety program, called the Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement. He says the rules are meant to prevent contamination on the farm.
So before we started harvesting this field a couple of days ago, we would walk the field to make sure that the same things, animal intrusion, trash or litter or something like that.
Though the industry rules don't have the force of law, once a farmer signs on, they are subject to unannounced inspections by the California Department of Food and Agriculture. Pizzini says about 99% of the leafy greens in California are now grown under the standards. But while the industry rules have helped restore consumer confidence, food safety watchdog groups say mandatory federal laws are needed. Elisa Odabashian is a food safety expert at Consumers Union, the publisher of Consumer Reports.
There are no other products out there, consumer products, that don't have safety standards required of them. Cars have safety requirements. Toys have safety requirements. The fact that this industry has gone for so long without the government saying you have to do these things to ensure safety in the marketplace is quite surprising.
Odabashian gives high marks to the food safety legislation passed by the House of Representatives last month. The bill would give the FDA greater authority to set safe farming practices and to order mandatory recalls of contaminated products. Currently, the agency can't do that. The bill would also require companies to tell the FDA when they detect pathogens like E. coli or Salmonella, and it would step up inspections. The new rules would apply to most food grown, processed, or imported into the U.S., though it doesn't cover meat and some egg products. Those are regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. After intense lobbying, many industry groups now support the House version of the bill. Tom Nassif, president of the Western Growers Association, says he's hopeful the FDA will base any detailed produce regulations on California's program.
It's given us the highest standards of anyone in the world when it comes to food safety for produce. We believe that's a good mechanism for dealing with food safety in our industry.
There are still concerns among some industry groups that the level of fines for producers who violate safety standards are too steep and could put some small farmers out of business. The Senate will likely face pressure to reduce those fines. Organic farmers, too, have argued that one-size-fits-all regulations could doom their operations. Those worries seem to have largely been addressed. The bill mandates the FDA take into account organic farming practices, wildlife habitat, and watershed protection. David Plunkett with the Center for Science and the Public Interest says most farmers are likely already doing much of what the FDA will mandate, like ensuring raw manure doesn't land on leafy vegetables that will be eaten raw by a consumer.
When you do surveys of farms, there's differences in the levels of knowledge about what are the risks. So this is a way of getting everybody uniformly recognizing where the potential risks are.
Plunkett says farms can't reduce the risk of salmonella, E. coli, and other contaminants to zero. Produce is, after all, grown outside and subject to the natural environment. But he says produce remains second only to seafood when it comes to outbreaks, and those are odds that can be greatly improved. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
Well, now that we've been on the farm, we'll head to the city and tag along with a guy who spends his day on the lookout for health code violations that could make consumers sick.
My name is Sheldon Liu. I'm with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. I'm one of the very many environmental health inspectors that do inspections of food places, laundromats, tattoo parlors, and we're mandated by state and federal and also city codes to do inspections. One of the places we're doing today is a little market. It's located in the southeast section of San Francisco, and we're going to walk through this market and look at things that we inspect. We see right now watermelons and oranges and unshucked fresh corn outside the awning. And that's a violation of the health code. We would like these foods, even though they're going to be washed, they should be underneath the awning. This grocery store is about less than 1,000 square feet, a fairly small grocery store, but it serves a purpose for the community in this area. You can see that a lot of the foods in this particular store has a lot of ethnic bearings on where it's coming from. So you can see it in different languages today. On the front counter of where the cashier sits, you see items such as pork rinds that are brined. These are pickled pork skins. If you look at it from the health department standpoint, we're looking for where it's coming from. In a lot of these communities, if they get something bad or they're not really sure, this whole community will talk, and they will not frequent this place, and that'll be like a death knell for this particular place. Okay, now we're finished at this place. Let's go to the next one. This is a large market that caters to Asian and Pacific Islanders. Oh, here's the balloons. These are duck eggs, and you see how big they are. And these duck eggs are preformed, preformed embryos. So as long as it's not broken open like this one here, then they're pretty much, they're safe. Okay. So this is a seafood area we're walking through. And over here on the other side, it's in the refrigerated case. We have bags of oysters. And we check to see if they have tags. Now we're coming to the barbecue area. What we're looking at right now is hanging barbecue ducks. There is a law about allowing this food to be up here for several hours in a whole form. Once it's cut, you have to put it into the steam table to keep it warm. Even then, they have so many hours in order for them to sell it.
Are there any questions?
Sheldon Liu, Senior Health Inspector for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Our tour with him was produced by Julieta Kuznir and Shuka Kalantari. To see a slideshow of some of the foods they examined, go to healthdialogues.org. After a short break, we'll return with tips for making sure food prepared in your own kitchen is healthy and safe, plus unexpected risks from growing your food in your own garden. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
As Congress considers a major overhaul of the U.S. healthcare system, next month Health Dialogues examines how the new state budget will affect healthcare closer to home. Will kids in low-income families be able to get basic services? What about the drug treatment programs mandated under Prop 36? And how could where you live affect the care you'll get? Healthcare and the California budget on the September episode of Health Dialogues.
And welcome back to Health Dialogues. We began this hour on food safety talking about what government does to protect the food supply, but there are also food dangers lurking in our own kitchens. To find out what they are and how to protect ourselves from them, we visited UC Davis food science professor Christine Bruhn at her home in Davis.
Hello.
Good morning.
How are you? I'm Scott Schaefer.
Hello, Scott.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to see you. I hear you all the time.
Oh, good to see you.
Please come in.
Dr. Bruhn directs the university's Center for Consumer Research. Sitting at her kitchen table, we began by talking about the most recent recall of ground beef. Out of concern, it might be contaminated with an especially dangerous strain of E. coli, known as 0157H7.
You know, an alert consumer needs to keep their eyes on the newspaper and their ears on the radio and the TV, because there seems to be recalls, you know, quite frequently. Right now, it's a company in California, and this company is voluntarily recalling their meat because it has salmonella. This is a particular variety of salmonella that is resistant to antibiotics. So it's a voluntary recall. The company is actually doing this because they are concerned about public health. If this was that specific E. coli, 0157H7, it would be a mandatory recall. It's huge. It's not just our state. It's adjacent states. It's meat that goes into under several different labels. It could be in your grocery store. So there seems to frequently be a recall. People need to go to the website if they have computer access, double-check the codes. For this particular one, it's been selling since June. So people could have something in their freezer.
Why is it that these recalls are so common? Why is it that the food is getting contaminated, and how is it getting contaminated?
Some believe that our food is less safe because you're hearing about these recalls. Actually, we have probably had this contamination in our products for many years, but today science is more accurate. They can identify these products, and by taking a fingerprint of the bacteria, they can relate the exact illness that a person has with the source that bacteria came from. With beef products, this is probably a contamination that may have come from the animal's hide during slaughter. Bacteria are everywhere in our environment. And knowing exactly where a pathogen came from is really speculation, and it takes a good deal of background work by scientists that are specially trained. A few years ago, California almonds were associated with salmonella, and the salmonella was likely from the dust in the fields. Sometimes when items are being washed, there is an aerosol that comes up from the washing, and that aerosol can even contain bacteria. It can land on a product, it can condense onto the walls, onto the ceilings, and in a processing plant can drip back on the product. So there are just a number of sources that are innocuous that you wouldn't think about that can actually become the source for a foodborne illness.
So just sticking with meat for a moment, how does a consumer at home protect himself, herself, from getting sick from something that may not be as safe as it should be?
We all must act as though a product is contaminated. So you wash your kitchen first, you wash your sink, you wash your hands, you even wash the faucet where you turn it on. You handle that product very, very carefully. You cook it very thoroughly. You wash your hands with soap and water. 20 seconds is what's recommended. Every time you touch anything else after having touched raw meat or raw poultry.
I would venture a guess that most people don't do a lot of those things, myself included.
Yeah, most people don't. We're actually lucky we don't get sick more frequently. And I think instead of saying the food supply is so contaminated, maybe the food supply is safer than we thought it was, or we would be sick many, many more times more. You know, I enjoy reading stories to my children, and I love The Little House on the Prairie and some of those other stories. And it's not uncommon for people to become ill and die, and you never know why they did, why they became ill. Now we have the science to know why. We can trace down where that illness came from, and we can control it if we use our head.
So when it comes to meat, how important is temperature? Because we're all taught, make sure you cook it till it's done, but how do you know when it's done?
For ground beef, the recommended temperature is 160 degrees on the inside. Now, I know most people don't take temperatures of their ground beef patties. If you're going to be cooking poultry, the recommended temperature is 165. When you're taking a temperature reading, you need to stick the thermometer in more than one spot because it can be uneven cooking. So you need to stick it into the thickest part and wait for the dial. Wait for the recording to come up. Oh, it's a pain to wait. Some people like the thermometers that have batteries. They are faster, but it still might be 5 to 10 to 15 seconds. My preferred thermometer is one my husband gave me for my birthday. It's an instant read. It really will tell you the temperature within 5 seconds at the most. It gets right up there. But whatever you use, use something to keep your family safe. Color is not adequate.
Well, I was going to say, you know, a lot of times I'll just kind of look. You know, we do a lot of barbecuing, things on the grill, and you just look at it or sometimes cut it open, which isn't, you're not really supposed to do either because that makes it tougher. But you can't just sort of eyeball it and tell?
Kansas State did a study a few years ago, and they validated that 1 out of 4 burgers turn brown before they reach 160 degrees. And 160 degrees is needed to destroy that E. coli that can make you so ill, in fact, can send you to the hospital. So color is not a good indicator. And in ground beef and ground chicken and ground turkey, that you really have got to get that internal temperature high enough because bacteria that had been on the outside could now be on the inside, and you gotta zap it with heat. Now, if it's something like a steak, you can eat a steak in the medium and medium rare stages if you wish, because once more, bacteria is on the surface. So when you sear that product, the outside will reach that required temperature, and you can destroy that bacteria.
Everyone says eat more vegetables, eat more fruit, and of course we know that's a good thing, but there is some danger lurking in fresh produce too, isn't there? We've heard about recalls of tainted spinach and lettuce, so how do you protect yourself there?
It's amazing. There have been more recalls now from produce than there have been from ground beef. The issue is with produce that you don't cook it. You often eat it raw, so you have to have a product that is free or has a very, very low level of these bacteria that can make you sick. And some like E. coli 015787 can send you to the hospital with as few as 10 cells. So you can't make mistakes there. You've got to really get it clean. If you're buying pre-washed greens, they have, in their washing, commercial washing, they've washed it 3 times. And any bacteria that can be removed by washing has been removed. You do not need to wash again pre-washed greens. In fact, you might even contaminate it if you haven't washed your hands or your kitchen sink well enough before you got these greens out. If it's something like you're buying a head lettuce or head spinach or other produce items that you wash at home, wash them under running water and rub gently with your hand to dislodge any bacteria. Actually, bacteria aren't just sitting there waiting for you to wash them off. They hook on. You can see under an electron microscope little rods of bacteria and strings coming out of them like ropes. I think of them as mountain climbers. And they are hooked on to that product, and they're not going to let go. So you help it a little bit by rubbing with your hands. You get a few more off. But even then, even the triple washing by the company, even the washing and rubbing by your hands will not reach those bacteria that have slipped into the stomata. That is the little part of the leaf where the plant has respiration, where it exchanges oxygen and moisture and carbon dioxide and all. Even then, sometimes the bacteria slips in there and you can't get it all out. That's why you've had people coming ill even from pre-washed lettuce or spinach.
Now, I tend to use at home, we use a salad spinner. Mm-hmm. And I will confess right now that I haven't washed the spinner very often. So I'm putting basically unwashed lettuce in, running water through it, spinning it, and then putting it into the bowl. That's probably not a great system, is it?
Actually, a salad spinner is very good. But next time, stick it in your dishwasher to get it clean also.
And all of us eat different kinds of foods. We have different kinds of diets. Some of us eat lots of meat. Some of us are vegetarians. Does what we eat make us more vulnerable or less vulnerable?
I've had students who've told me they don't have to worry about foodborne illness because they're vegetarians. I say, hey, wake up. Bacteria is everywhere, and they can be on your lettuce. They can be on your wonderful vegetables. If you're eating something raw that's not cooked, you better handle it right. You better wash it. You better keep it at the appropriate temperature, keep it cool enough to keep that bacteria from growing. So you've got to consider your own health and your own situation. Some of us are at higher risk, and many people know children are at high risk, old people are at high risk. I tell you, it's not old people. It's when you are about 55 or so, your susceptibility for foodborne illness increases.
Why is that?
Primarily the difference in your stomach acidity, and you're just, your resistance has just changed. So you feel very young at 55. But you can still be at increased risk. If you're pregnant, you're at increased risk. If you're diabetic, you are. So it's just not, folks in the retirement home that need to be extra cautious. We all need to be careful.
It's easy to get paranoid, and hearing all these risks and bacteria that are clinging to your lettuce and all that. How do you balance being cautious and prudent without, getting too paranoid?
Yeah, we still need to enjoy life. I think the critical thing is make sanitation a part of your system. So you wash your hands before you unpack your groceries, before you start meal preparation, anytime after you've touched anything that's going to be eaten raw. Just wash your hands. Have the soaps and the paper towels right beside the sink. Wash your sink also. Then make sure your refrigerator is cold enough. It needs to be 40 degrees or less.
Can we just walk over to your fridge and open it up and I can ask you a few questions?
Sure
over
enough.
There? All right, let's go.
Actually, it's pretty full right now.
What's that?
It's full right now.
Oh, it's pretty full. Good. Okay.
The door of your refrigerator is the warmest part of the refrigerator. So I never put wonderful things that I enjoy, like milk or juice or fruit or even eggs, in the door, because they will get warm. Every time I open the door, they warm up. I have a refrigerator thermometer in my refrigerator. Actually, I have two. One I keep in the door, and when we pull that out, there's a little blue line that tells you where the temperature is supposed to be, and the red line is right at the 40 degrees, and that's the warmest part of my refrigerator. That's the door. And inside the depth of the refrigerator, it's cooler than that. It's lower. It's about 38.
Now, what with milk, there's always, of course, the date. Sometimes I wonder, is that the sell date? Is it the use date? And what if you buy it well before the expiration, but open it? Once you've opened it, does that change how soon you could eat it? And what if it, sometimes it's on the border and I'll just kind of smell it.
But with milk products, they have been pasteurized, and that destroys any harmful bacteria. So the date is there as a guide for selling. My experience is in a cool refrigerator, that milk can last for definitely a week and sometimes 10 days or even longer.
A lot of people will cook, you know, big meal for their family, save the leftovers, put them in a container and send them off to school with the kids or something like that. What kind of precautions should we take?
The important thing with leftovers is you put them in the refrigerator within an hour or two of when you serve the original food item. If it's a super hot day, you're outside, it's above 90, get that in the refrigerator within an hour. If it's normal room temperature, get it in the refrigerator within two.
So just summarize for us, if you would. When you boil it all down, like, what does it come down to?
You know, there's a partnership on food safety education. It's called Fight Back. Fight Back, Fight Bacteria. And it includes choosing foods that are safe, separating raw from cooked foods, be sure you're clean all the time, be sure your refrigerator is cold enough, and be sure to cook to the right temperature. Those are the basic guidelines.
Professor Bruhn, thanks for all the tips.
My pleasure.
Christine Bruhn directs the Center for Consumer Research at UC Davis. Commercial fish, the kind we buy in grocery stores or restaurants, are monitored by the FDA, but sport fishing is not regulated. All across the Golden State, anglers are casting their lines into lakes and coastal waters, hoping for a bite. But in many places, pollution leaves the fish unsafe to eat. Mina Kim reports on who protects our health when it comes to eating sport fish safely.
On a windy afternoon at the Berkeley Marina, anglers drop their lines into the choppy waves of the San Francisco Bay. John Hahn is one of them. He says he goes fishing about three times a week.
I tend to catch mostly stripers, halibut.
But Hahn says he doesn't eat everything he catches. He's heard about chemicals in the water that can contaminate the fish.
Wherever I go, I see like signs posted about mercury and, you know, how much to consume a month.
Health officials say it isn't safe to eat fish caught in the bay more than twice a month. It's a simple message, but getting it to folks like Hahn is a complex process. First, thousands of fish need to be collected from water bodies across the state and tested for contaminants.
We have a lot of coolers and sample collection gear.
Jay Davis takes me on a tour of the San Francisco Estuary Institute. Davis is senior scientist here and also leads the statewide effort to test fish. Collection teams try to catch the most popular fish that tend to have the most toxins, like bass and carp. Davis says it's a huge effort because when you cast your line,
you never know what you're going to get. It's like Forrest Gump and his chocolates. You never get everything you target, so a lot of effort needs to go in to get as close as you can to getting all the target species.
The next big job is lab testing the fish tissue for poisons. The most common is mercury. California's gold rush left toxic mercury from old mercury in gold mining. Oil refineries and urban waste add more mercury to the environment. Davis says just a teaspoon of mercury can poison an entire lake, so he has to look for tiny amounts of it in the fish.
We look at mercury at concentrations of below a part per million, and then many of the other pollutants are around a one part per billion.
The fish are tested for seven different toxins, including DDT and polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. They were used in electrical equipment, paints, and caulks. PCBs were banned in 1979, but persist in the environment to this day.
PCBs is the, you know, it's the second most important chemical in our advisories.
Robert Broadberg is chief of the Fish and Water Quality Evaluation Unit for the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. He takes the data from the fish tissue tests and uses it as a starting point to figure out how much of it we can eat. Then he issues fish consumption advisories.
Based on the toxicity of a particular chemical, we say that it's safe to eat one serving per week or perhaps two servings or three servings. Or in some cases, we say, well, the contaminant levels in this fish are too high to consume.
Eating fish contaminated with mercury can cause brain damage and learning disabilities, especially in children and developing fetuses. PCBs have been linked to cancer. But issuing advisories isn't as simple as it sounds. Elise Ujihara says the advice changes depending on your age, gender, and even the type of fish you eat.
The advisories do tend to be very complicated, and they could vary from water body to water body.
Ujihara is a research scientist for the California Department of Public Health. Part of her job is to simplify the messages.
This is a sign that we developed with our stakeholder group.
At her office in Richmond, she shows me a bright yellow warning sign for fish caught in the Sacramento Delta. It's been color-coded based on a traffic light. Fish in the red section should be avoided, like striped bass or sturgeon. Fish in the green section, salmon or trout, can be eaten up to three times a week.
The message we're trying to put out is not, do not eat fish. We're really trying to reduce exposures from fish that have high levels of chemicals.
But the message to limit your fish consumption isn't reaching everyone. Torm Nonpresert is a Laotian community organizer in Richmond for the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. Richmond is home to several industrial factories and some of the most polluted waters in the Bay Area. But Nonpresert says Laotians fish here regularly.
In the Laotian community, we don't just go fish for fun. We go fish for food.
According to a study by the San Francisco Estuary Institute, Asians and African Americans are more likely to eat contaminated bayfish than other racial groups. Nonpresert says with the economic downturn, he worries more Laotian families are practicing subsistence fishing.
I bet that besides looking for a job, they probably in the shoreline almost every day go fishing because people have to do whatever they can to survive.
But Nonpresert says it's hard to warn people in this insular immigrant community. Laotians have more than 62 dialects, and few read and write in their own language, let alone in English.
You cannot just print out a flyer and send to everybody, and then hopefully that will do the job. You really have to talk to them in person and to explain to them how the fish contaminated.
But that kind of organizing takes resources Nonpresert's group doesn't have.
That's sort of where we
back at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, scientist Jay Davis says he feels the pinch too.
Every year there's concern that the budget could be cut. So we try to plan around that. It's not easy.
Davis says he suspects only a fraction of the water bodies that need fish consumption warnings have them. But there is one bright spot. The State Water Board has launched a new web portal called My Water Quality. Some of the data Davis has collected on fish contamination will be accessible here in a few months. For Health Dialogues, I'm Mina Kim.
Well, you'd like to think nothing could be safer than growing your own vegetables, right? Well, not always. With urban gardening on the rise, people need to think about the safety of the soil in their own backyards. Julieta Kuznir has more.
If you're on a mission to eat fresh produce on the cheap, growing your own may seem like your best bet. That's what Joyce Lee, a West Oakland resident, thought when she signed up with City Slicker Farms to get help building a garden in her backyard.
We like all vegetables. So the cabbage, the collards, and the mustards, and green onions, kale, squash, cucumbers. So that's why I say every kind of vegetable you can think we like.
As you can see, we're doing in-ground beds today, and we're going to do a modified double digging method.
City Slicker Farms is a nonprofit working to make healthy foods more accessible to low-income West Oakland residents. They run affordable farmers markets and distribute free produce grown on urban farms in the same area. They also help residents like Joyce grow their own food. To date, they've built over 100 gardens. In Joyce's neighborhood, grocery stores are the exception. Corner stores selling alcohol and packaged foods dominate. West Oakland has high rates of both malnutrition and obesity, which makes growing your own food about more than just saving money. But there's a downside that the novice gardener needs to consider: lead and other heavy metals in soil. Alameda County, which includes Oakland, is on the top 10 list of reported lead poisoning cases among children. 60% of these cases involve lead in either paint or soil. Lead exposure is particularly dangerous for children under 6, who are notorious for putting everything in their mouths.
There hasn't been an established level of lead in the blood that is considered safe. So we want to do everything that we can to reduce people's exposure to lead.
That's Dale Hagen, Housing Services Manager for Alameda County Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. To minimize the risk, federal and state regulations mandate lead levels below 400 parts per million in soil on children's playgrounds. Hagen says there are many reasons why lead can end up in soil.
Wherever we have older housing or buildings where the paint ends up peeling off, as well as high traffic areas near freeways and major traffic ways, as well as industrial areas, then you tend to see higher levels of lead in the environment, in the soil. And Oakland has a lot of older housing, major industrial areas, and some major freeways and highways.
Hagen recommends people test their soil for lead before they start planting. There are plenty of labs that will provide quick results for as little as $8. Ronald Almondson, professor of soil science at UC Berkeley, says the soil around us is like an archaeological site. It can carry all kinds of toxic residue from the past.
It's interesting. I've done this on campus for my students. I've taken them out of the classroom and we've gone out and looked at the chemistry of the soils here on the Berkeley campus. And even in the most pristine locations that I've been able to find, the soil surface has a increased concentrations in things like lead, zinc, chromium, even arsenic, are to some degree elevated even here on the Berkeley campus.
Even the White House garden tested positive for lead, though not in quantities that are considered harmful. Okay, so say you pay your $8, send your soil to be tested, and you get bad news. What's a gardener to do? Julie Pavick, the backyard garden coordinator for City Slicker Farms.
We want to make sure that their yard is a safe place to grow food for them and their families. After that, we get the results back. If there's anything to be concerned about, we talk about some of the risks with folks and help them make informed decisions about growing food. And then from there, we work to build a garden with them.
Pavick explains that some veggies absorb less lead than others. Fruits, like tomatoes, all the way up to lemon trees, take up far less lead than potatoes and carrots that grow underground. She also says that peeling and washing makes a big difference. Some other ways to deal with contaminated soil includes raised planter beds and adding lime to change the pH of soil. Fortunately, Joyce's soil test came back without significant levels of lead. She already has plans for the fruits of her labor.
If the garden does well, we can share with other people because a lot of people don't have a yard, you know, where they can plant and grow their own vegetables. So if you can have enough, so your neighbors or whoever can have a fresh vegetable without paying for it. Because, I mean, it's really hard. Everybody don't have money.
For Health Dialogues, I'm Julieta Kuznid.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to all our guests for joining us this hour. And don't forget, everything you just heard and much more is available on our website. It's healthdialogues.org. You can listen to our show, subscribe to the podcast, even suggest your own topic ideas, and of course, you can also get involved in the conversation. That's healthdialogues.org. Tune in for next month's Health Dialogues, when we'll explore how state budget cuts will affect health services in California. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our engineer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering by Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The Health Dialogues team includes Polly Stryker, Susie Rocho, Gabriel Cohen, Nick Vidinsky, Erica Kelly, and Shuka Kalantari. And we say thanks and good luck to our terrific intern, Julieta Kuznir, who leaves us after this month. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org. And the members of KQED Public Radio.